He is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He's a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum at 6 p.m. for Bagrum on Law and Life. 101.9 High FM. 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Hi, thank you for joining us this evening. It's Michael Bagrum at 6 to 7 p.m. every Tuesday evening. I appreciate you tuning in, so thank you very much. Like per normal, I'm going to have a little book that I want to introduce you to, and then I'm going to introduce you to our guest. We've got a wonderful guest this evening. We're very excited about that. But let me first introduce you to my book. The book I'm looking at is appropriate for this time of the year because I've just been away up into the Karoo for a few days on my motorbike, and I've been looking at a book called West Coast and Beyond. So I'm looking now at possibly looking at a trip up the West Coast and the little villages around the West Coast. I'm hoping that it won't be too hot. I'm hoping that there'll be some places in guest houses for me to book in. There will be restaurants and whatever. But this book, West Coast and Beyond, is done by Ursula Stevens. It's an absolutely fantastic book because it tells you where you can find interesting towns, tells you a little bit about each town. It gives you the maps, history of the town, what's interesting to see there, what routes you should be taking. Absolutely wonderful stuff. So if anyone's interested and you want to go on a trip up the West Coast when you're on your visit to Cape Town, an absolute must. It's called West Coast and Beyond by Ursula Stevens, S-T-E-V-E-N-S. Absolutely wonderful read, and I'm enjoying it, and I'm going to make use of it. But we have tonight our guest, Advocate Steve Kirk-Cohen, SC. Steve is with us on air this evening. I'm going to take you through a little bit of his CV. I'm just going to touch on it, but I'm going to ask him himself to hear from the man himself a little bit about his background, his schooling, his life in Pretoria, early days, his early history in law. I met him first when I met him. I think I was in my second or third year at Rhodes University at law school. And Stephen arrived there. We had some interaction with a club that we both joined, and we became friends over the years. And of course, we've practiced law in Cape Town for both of us beyond 40 years, I think it is. And we've interacted with each other over this time. He also happens to be a person who lives two houses away from me in Rocklands Avenue, up in Highlands Estate, around the corner from United Herzstedt Schools. So Stephen, he was a son of an advocate, and I think his mom was an attorney, but he'll go through that with us. I know, interesting, he tells me that his grandfather became the chief registrar of deeds in South Africa. So that's interesting, but about his interesting past, I didn't know that. I know that he was at school in Pretoria in the 60s and 70s, and I know that he, at the school in Pretoria, he had to, at the end of the schooling, do his national service. He tells a little bit of a story about that. I don't think he enjoyed his national service too much. He was with the SA Navy. He calls it the worst 2 years of his life, very different to me because my time in the military was absolutely fantastic. Not that I'm a soldier, not that I can do a sit-up, and I wasn't issued with a rifle, but I had time prosecuting in the military, so I actually enjoyed it. He came to Rhodes University, I think, Steve, about 1980, I think it was, 2 years before, 2 years after me. Qualified his degree first and qualified in 1983. The bottom line is we now many years later, over 40 years, like I said, obviously went to the bar. He'll tell us a bit about his route through the bar, his early days, who did he do pupillage with, and some of the people that he worked with as a junior. So Steve Kirkcone, SC, welcome and thank you for joining us. Thank you for giving us of your time. And I know that when I put people on the spot like that, they're quite bashful, but I want you to actually share with us some of the great things that you've done. You've had a stellar community operation over here. You've helped many people in Cape Town and beyond, and your career at the bar has been absolutely superb. Even as a junior and now for almost 20 years or over 20 years as a senior counsel. So Steve, welcome.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you. And thank you for having me on Radio Chai. Pleasure to be here.
Absolute pleasure. And I'm very happy with myself that I managed to pin you down. So thank you. Steve, tell us a little bit about your primary years, your high school in Pretoria, and what brought you to Cape Town eventually.
Well, Michael, it's one of the most common questions that people ask of lawyers is what happened in your life that you decided to become a lawyer? And looking back on it, it would have been a miracle if I'd done anything else, because I was really surrounded by them. My mother was, as you mentioned, she was Pretoria's second female attorney. My father was an advocate, first a judge's registrar, then an advocate, and then a judge. My grandfather travelled all over the country as a registrar of deeds and ultimately became the chief registrar of deeds in Pretoria and retired from there age 60 only to become a practicing attorney, doing his articles age 60, and practiced at London and Tyndall, where he became a partner before he retired from there as well. So my life was full of law right from the beginning. I can remember discussions with my father around the dinner table from the time when I was younger than 10, giving me lessons on various aspects of law. And in fact, I remembered when Oscar Pistorius was in the news, but I have a conscious memory of my father teaching me the difference between dolus eventualis and dolus directus before I was 10.
I still don't understand it, but anyway, go ahead. Sorry,
interrupted. Oh yes, there's a. I did my schooling in Pretoria, as you mentioned, and got out of Pretoria with great glee. Went down to Rhodes, where I had a wonderful time, met some very interesting people, not least you. got politically involved, following again in your footsteps. And it was a tough time, in a sense. It was probably not the worst days of apartheid. They were still to come in the 1980s under the state of emergency. But it was a tense, tense society. Pretoria was tense. I realized that going back in my Rhodes days, that it was a very conservative society, and the racial friction between English and Afrikaans, not the racial, the friction between English and Afrikaans was very noted, because until 1948, the civil service in Pretoria had been very English. And it became very Afrikaans with the arrival of the National Party. So you had the combination of English and Afrikaans rivalry. I don't think I had a single Afrikaans speaking friend when I was in 20 years in Pretoria. And there was all the racial tension going on at the time, which we both lived through in Rhodes, with NUSAS and anti-NUSAS activities. I remember vividly that my father told me in a phone call one day after I'd become politically involved that he was horrified that Langley, the minister, I think he was minister of, I forget what he was minister of. What was Tom Langley minister of?
Oh, yeah, I can't remember. It wasn't justice.
No. He walked into my father's chambers one day and told him what I'd been saying on a platform at Rhodes University the night before.
Yeah.
And okay. It didn't horrify me that the National Party had the ability to find out what was being said on podia in universities, but that they took the interest in knowing what was going on in Rhodes is just, to me, it was mind-boggling. So that those eyes were everywhere, and it was a tough time.
Well, I don't know if you recall, but we both met up at a society which was started by advocate Isaac Smuts, SC, who still remains a common friend of ours,
yes.
who often sits on the bench in the Eastern Cape. And I still speak to Isaac Smuts regularly, or normally once a month or so. But he started an organization called the Union Student Freedom, Enlightenment and Welfare, which then translated into us few.
You, yes, indeed.
Yeah. And we joined this, and the funniest part was it started as a joke, as I could a couple of beers too many, and decided that us few need to have an organization. And it then became a bit of a serious organization. We would have political discussions, philosophical discussions. You became the chairman of us few when I left campus. As I could already gone to the bar, I had
Yes,
left
that's
campus.
right.
You became the chairman, and you ran an august organization with, in fact, the
Indeed.
administration still giving us a donation to keep the us few going. There were
Yes,
very
indeed.
few of us. I also remember the early days of NUSAS as well. And it was, we had lots of fun. Unfortunate, my neighbor, Guy Berger, who is still around and I speak to from time to time as well, landed up in jail for thought crimes, effectively.
Yes.
Hadn't done anything wrong, but thought crimes. He put pamphlets together and whatever. I don't know if you recall all those
I
naughty
do.
days of Rhodes University.
Indeed,
But
I remember you as the chairman of VegSoc running for president for the sole purpose of trying to keep John Campbell out.
yeah, that was actually lots of fun as well. And of course, we also got some money from the campus to keep VegSoc going so we could have supper once a year. But that was about what all we did. Just to go back to your early days, coming then thereafter from Rhodes University. And you didn't go to the sidebar, you went straight to the bar, I take it.
Michael, I was lucky or unlucky enough, depending which way you view it, to have my mother put in her all for me in Pretoria at Savage Ursa and Adams, where she'd been a partner. And she prevailed on one of her former partners to take me in for the 3 month vacs at the end of the year to be one step lower than an articled clerk, which was pretty damn low. I landed up doing what even the articled clerks didn't want to do. But I knew at the end of I did it for 4 years. I knew at the end of 4 3-month holidays working at Savage Ursa and Adams that it was either the bar or bust for me. There was no way that I wanted to be an attorney. And so I came to Cape Town, having fallen in love with the place. One of the things that I did at Rhodes was I became a provincial fencer. And the closest fencing club to Rhodes University was in Cape Town. And we used to trek down for weekends, and I'd fence as often as I could. And I decided to make Cape Town my home, following the experience of the Gilgets, where Brian Gilgett decided it had been a most unwise thing to try to practice before his father, a judge in Pretoria, and so he scuttled off to Natal, and I decided it was a damn good idea to scuttle off to Cape Town and not be an advocate in the same division as my judicial father.
Yeah, that's a recipe for disaster, especially if you land up appearing in front of your father. Give
Yes.
you your client was not going to benefit from that at all. But yeah, so you came to Cape Town. Did you do your pupillage? Obviously, who did you do pupillage
I
under?
did pupillage with Dave Lenoff.
Ah, I remember Dave. He's living in Australia
Yes, he's
today.
living in
Yes,
Australia. Yeah. And
wonderful.
I started off as most people do, doing anything that comes your way. I had, like you, decided that I wanted to be a labor lawyer, having been lectured to by the inimitable Sarah Christie at Rhodes. And I kept up on this fast developing field and read about it and studied it in my own time and didn't get a single brief in labor law. Until 1997, I decided I might as well give it up after 10 years at the bar and realize that I wasn't going to have a labor law practice. And when the 1997 Act, the amendment came around, I let my knowledge fall into disuse. And no
Just can I
sooner.
stop you? Okay, you said something about Sarah Christie. I don't know if you know, but she recently passed on
Yes, I do know.
about a month ago. And yeah, I kept in touch with her for many years. She was ailing. Her mind was going. She was in an unhappy space. But what a wonderful woman. She also became the head of the CCMA Western Cape.
Yes, I heard.
And I don't know if you recall all of that. So had a stellar career, was an amazing law lecturer, had lectured me in the law of evidence, and once even threw a piece of chalk at me, which I managed to duck and it hit someone behind me. I was very happy with that. But what a wonderful woman. So yeah,
Was a very
thoughts
fond
go out
memory
to her
of that.
family. Yeah, thoughts go out to the family. But sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, I was saying that no sooner had I given up keeping my labor law current than I started picking up a practice in labor law, and I think that's when you and I became
Yeah,
reacquainted.
we absolutely did. You at the time also did some work. You interacted with people like Sharkey King, Lewis Dyson,
Yes.
and also Lewis Dyson. By you had some contact, you said, with a cousin of his or a nephew or something, but his daughter was at Rhodes University with us as well. I
Oh, I
don't know
didn't
if
know
you
that.
know that. Yeah. So Amira Dyson was there at Rhodes University. And she actually then introduced me to him on one holiday. And just a small anecdotal story, I went to go and say hello to him in his study at home. He was living in Claremont. He had this study where the books were packed right up to the ceiling. And I walked into the study to say hello. He was staring at the ceiling. And I said hello, and he said hello, but I carried on staring at the ceiling with a bit of a strange man. And I said, "Can I help you with anything?" He was looking quite sort of lost. He said, "Yes, there's a book up there that I need, and I've forgotten how to get it down." And I said, "Well, clearly you're going to need a ladder." And he said, "That's a good thing, but do you have a ladder?" I said, "No, this is your house, not mine." I then went off and asked Mrs. Dyson for the ladder, who gave me the ladder. I brought it. I went to get the book, came down with the book, and then he said, "You brought me the wrong one." I said, "Well, you were pointing at that one." He said, "Well, it's still the wrong one." Anyway, I had to go back and do it. So but he was a wonderful character. I don't know if you ever worked with him, but an amazing guy.
I did work with him. He was an unforgettable man, and one of my the people that I first met at the bar, who were people of conscience and of determination to overcome the travails of apartheid. He was absolutely magnificent, and he never gave up. And he was on the same floor as me for in the time that I joined in 1985, until his death.
Yeah, an absolutely amazing guy, and I know an absolute genius because he was running a law practice before our constitution, and yet was a constitutional law expert. And used to, I remember, and I mean, I briefed him a few times. And I remember him using the French constitution to justify legal principles here in South Africa, and the judges used to be scratching their head trying to work out how is this going to help them or how are they going to disabuse him of this concept? But he'd go on for hours about it. You also did some work, I see, from your CV with other, I mean, for instance, Sharkey King. You did some work as well with other SCs. Tell us a little bit about getting sort of life practice from these guys and get some of it rubbed off onto you, I'm sure.
Yes, it did. I was never a very happy junior in the sense that I prefer working alone, and it was rare to find someone with whom I could develop rapport. But I certainly learned a great deal, and met a great deal of. I met a number of absolutely unforgettable people. Owen Rogers sticks out head above shoulders among the advocates that I've ever worked with. He was truly exceptional, and I one of my fields of interest is that I've kept up with information technology since it arrived in the 1980s, and I've been the chairman of the Communication and Technology Committee of the Bar since its inception. And I thought that I would be okay because Owen was doing a case about IT, and I was there to help. And my first exposure was to have a consultation with him with a learned professor from UCT the next day. And there were two parts of this professor's report that I just didn't understand, but I thought, I understand most of it. And the consultation started off with Owen saying, "Professor, there are only two points in your report that I think we need to discuss. And of course, they were the 2 points that I just didn't understand at all. And Owen took off this discussion at a level that was right up there. And I was supposed to be taking a note of what this discussion was about. And I was sitting with my fingers poised over a keyboard. And we got to the end of this 30-minute discussion, and he said, "Thank you, Professor. I think that's all that we need to know. It's fairly simple. Thank you, Steve. Did you get a note of that?" And I looked down, and I hadn't pressed a key yet. And I
Oh,
died waiting for the consultation. But yeah,
okay.
he was an absolutely exceptional brain, person of great commitment and erudition.
You also worked with people like Bertie Hoberman, who I remember very well. Was quite a
Yes, I did.
character, Bertie Hoberman, and you worked a lot with him, from what I understood.
Yes, I did a lot, a fair amount with him.
And then, of course, Peter Hodous, the Cape
Yes,
Town
I
Peter Hodous,
worked with Peter.
and Skalk Berger, Doug Shaw, and of
Worked with
course,
Scott,
Jeremy
worked with Doug,
Gauntlett.
worked with Jeremy Gauntlet.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences there with some of these people.
Well, I had a short and sharp stint as a junior to Jeremy Gauntlet, and we parted on the basis that we would never speak again, and we didn't really.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be wrong not to say a word about Peter Hodous. I mean, I think he's leaving his chambers now, sadly. But his best friends told him a couple of years ago that it was time for him to go, and he said, "Yes, I know, but I'm not going." And he
Yeah,
stayed
that's
around,
Peter.
yeah.
That's Peter for sure, yeah.
And I have had him as an opponent. I've had him as a leader, and I've had him as a friend. He's a wonderful man.
And of course, all this time you were on the 12th floor at Huguenot Chambers. I know you moved once or twice, but you're always on the 12th floor. Whenever I come to the 12th floor, I expected to see you.
40 years on the same floor, yes.
Yeah, and I think you're still there. Are you still on the 12th?
I'm still just
In
looking
fact,
at me in
she's not looking at you right now on the 12th floor. And
1201, yeah.
Huguenot, well done. Well done. Not much changes. I
No.
do remember coming to brief you in your chambers, and before I knew what a computer was, to tell you the truth, this is probably about 40 years ago. You were a junior then, I was a junior attorney, and you had this computer out with two screens, and you were taking notes on both screens, which then put onto a massive, I don't know if you managed to screen it onto almost a movie, so we
Yeah.
could all see what we were talking about. I was absolutely gobsmacked. I didn't know whether to look at you or the screen or what I was doing. And I don't think any of us knew what was going on, because you had our whole consultation was almost simultaneously filmed onto this big screen where you kept your notes, long before anyone had a laptop even.
Yes,
What brought you into that?
I came to the bar. I'd done a in the Navy. I'd learned how to type. It was the only thing that I was grateful to the South African Defence Force for. And I bought an electric typewriter and took it to Rhodes with me and typed out my notes for 5 years because my writing is so bad that I couldn't read my notes 30 minutes after being in the lecture. So I would assiduously type through my university years. And right at the end of my 5th year there, someone came to me and said this. The Rhodes University has got something called a word processor. Can you type my thesis on it? So I went down to go and see what this thing was. It was from floor to ceiling, and it had disks, which I kid you not, were about that size. And
Yeah,
you put them
big
in.
solid discs. Yeah, I remember that.
And I got into computing at Rhodes, and it stayed with me ever since.
And you've kept up to date with all the changes that are happening almost monthly. I haven't. I'm still dictating into an analog dictaphone.
Oh, really?
I have, yeah. So the rest of my firm all come and chuckle. I'm dictating on this handheld dictaphone. I still can't type. Luckily, I've got a thing called Dragon Dictate, which is also ancient, but it does. I can le dictate and get the sort of semblance of notes coming out of my computer. But
It's proof that
I've never kept up.
Proof that
Sorry?
ancient things can type.
I still can't, but I do that. Just to look at your career has been absolutely amazing, and we're going to come just now to some of the interesting cases that you've had. But just to sort of make a comment, and please forgive me for this, but you've been known as a formidable opponent. A lot of your colleagues see you as a person who comes to court well prepared, well read, it's fully been briefed by your witnesses completely. And I must say, and I know that because I've been practicing so long, so I know sort of 80% of the attorneys in Cape Town. When you've been briefed on the other side, they know that you're going to come completely and utterly prepared. There's going to be no chink in the armor. You do a lot of work, a lot of homework before you actually do the appearance. Is that time consuming? Is it a passion? What is it? Because I know, and I've briefed advocates who haven't read the papers by the time we get into court. So you're exactly the opposite.
Michael, there are some cases that you can do flying by the seat of your pants with very little knowledge of the facts because they're about law. And there are people who are very good at that. I'm particularly bad at that. I prefer to go into a case knowing every last bit of the detail and only then making a decision as to whether you'll conduct it on a micro granule level, because that's what the case requires, or whether you'll skate over the surface and talking and take it on general principles. And I don't believe that you can responsibly be a lawyer and not know the detail, because sometimes it comes back to bite you when the opposition does. So yes, I've always believed in that, and I've always believed that proper preparation, particularly in trial matters, which are my first love, trial matters where cross-examination is required. I say with pride that I'm known as a formidable cross-examiner. And always have been. In fact, I've recently I took I had to smile wryly when I was reported to the LPC for brutality in cross-examination.
Can I stop
And
you there? Because it's a good point to stop. We're going to come off the air completely, log off, and then log on in 1 minute. They're going to have a quick ad break to pay the bills.
he is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He's a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum at 6 p.m. for Bagrum on Law and Life, 101.9 High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for joining us again. And it's always good to pay our bills by having the advertising. This evening, I'm joined by Advocate Steve Kirk-Cohen, SC, a senior counsel, someone who I've been friendly with since my early days at university. Today, he's a senior counsel still practicing over 40 years later, probably close on 50 years. And Steve, we were talking about some of the interesting things that you were doing and how you well prepared for cases. And I know you've got, and I say this word advisedly, you've got a formidable reputation by being so well prepared, being a great cross-examiner, but someone who you can't trip up with the facts at all. And you're telling us that you actually want to do that. You like doing that because you need to be well prepared. I recently, well, not that recently, about 3 or 4 years ago, briefed a senior counsel from Cape Town. We arrived at court and he hadn't read the papers. Obviously, he'll never see me again, but it came as a shock to me as an attorney because we were paying decent money for this representation and he was so sure that it was going to be settled that this thing backfired. Luckily, we did settle it in the end. I was almost forced to settle it. But it shows you the karma catches you. If you're extremely well prepared, those are cases that run smoothly. It's a bit like Gary Player. The more I practice, the luckier I get. You want to
Yes.
comment on that?
No, that's perfectly correct. I'm afraid there are people who believe in taking shortcuts. I've never been one of those. I believe in working more hours than you need to just to make sure that you know it all well.
Okay, so you've had that career at the bar. Obviously, One also has some outside interests. I know because practicing as an attorney, I never really wanted to be an attorney. I often think to myself, what am I going to do when I grow up? But unfortunately, I'm almost grown up at this point and I'm still practicing an attorney, but I do have other interests. I know that you go hiking quite a bit. I know that you've had all sorts of sporting. You've had what you were telling us about your fencing. I presume no more. You're not
No more of
21
that.
anymore, but you're still doing a lot of external work. But I also know that you had put your hand in quite deeply into the winemaking explanation. Give us an explanation of this winemaking. I've never,
Yes,
by the
I'll
way, had a gift of a bottle of wine, but just for mention. But go ahead, Davido.
During the COVID days, I was very popular. I'm surprised that you weren't
I
one of the many of my
wasn't a
friends.
recipient, no, which is a very sadly so, but I'll hold you to it.
Yes, back in the year 2000, I barged in where angels fear to tread, and with the assistance of my late colleague Jan Marais, started a venture to make Garagista wine. And I'm now 25 years later, and I've made 23 vintages. I sadly had to skip two during COVID, where it wasn't possible. But yes, I learned very slowly. I made some awful stuff to start with. I've made some relatively decent wine. I got 4.5 stars in 2007 for a Cabernet Sauvignon made in Penhill. And what started off as a hobby, thinking, well, how difficult can it be? It became an all-consuming passion to the extent that I actually planned. I just love the harvest time, and I was counting down how many harvests I had left in me before I had to give up. And I realized that there weren't enough, and the only way that I could get more was to go and try to do an overseas harvest. And I tried very hard to do one in Italy. In fact, I had it all laid on until 2017, and went across to do a ton of grapes, and found that summer had arrived earlier than ever in Italian history, and the harvest was over. So I missed it,
Nice.
and I never went back to do it. But I'm still a dedicated winemaker, and I really enjoy it. I must say, Michael, that I one of the things that deterred me about being an advocate was my father's own private life, where he didn't have one. He was wedded to the law, and he found himself at a terrible loose end when he gave up the law. And I was determined that I was never going to allow that to happen to me. So I've actually got an abundance of outside interests. I do winemaking, I've done carpentry. I'm very keen in the kitchen. I'm a sourdough baker. I'm sure you got a loaf of sourdough during
I've
COVID.
that I've been a recipient of, and thank you. As you can see from my girth, I've really enjoyed that. Yes.
So yes, I have a plethora of interests, and it stood me in good stead. On the subject of judges, my father and I were probably the antithesis of one another in a sense. He was from a school called the Positivists, whose dictum was my job is to say the law, not make the law, saying making the law was the function of Parliament and pronouncing on the law was the function of a judge. And I wrestled with that. I was always profoundly unhappy with it. And I was my father was not my favorite judge, although he's obviously one of my favorite people. And I met the most amazing judges who were exceptional at law and who were, if I say, Menshevik beyond belief. And I'm thinking particularly of Ezra Goldstein, who I asked if he would come tonight. I don't know if he's on air, but he,
I
I'm
think he might be because I did chat to him and I did warn him that you were coming on air. And I think he might be because if you're going to say something nasty about him, he's listening very carefully. So you better watch yourself. Okay, sorry.
I have nothing but good to say about Ezra. I think he's probably one of my favorite judges in South African history.
And a great guy as well, not
Yes.
just a favorite judge, but a wonderful person. And I think he is on air. And Ezra, if you're on here, thank you for listening in. I really appreciate it and for getting back to me so quickly. But Steve did specially ask me to ask you if you could be on air so he could give you the accolades that he's giving you right now. Sorry, I interrupted.
Shalom, Ezra. I hope you're there. I never forget being in Ezra's motion court up in Johannesburg, where there were, I don't know, 370 matters, and he worked out that he could have 45 seconds per matter. How he was going to do this, nobody knew except Ezra. And he would call a matter and he'd say, "Mr. Bagram, you need to go and think about this. And Mr. Kirkhone, don't you smile. You're going to be in trouble on this point. Just go and talk to one another. Next case, please."
Lovely.
And he would manage this role and send people scuttling, pointing out the weak points in their case and the strength of their opponent's case. And one by one, they'd come back and say, can we just mention matter 72 on your lordship's roll? The matter's settled. Thank you. Next."
Well
It
done.
was absolutely magnificent to see that kind of ease under pressure that that Ezra could show.
Oh, well done, Ezra. And obviously, you've had the honorable mention, and I'm pleased you were, if you were, and otherwise, we'll send you a recording of this in due course. You obviously, sending the life in the law, you've met interesting people, and you took Sulk in 2005, if I can go backwards a little bit. And obviously, that practiced your, put your practice into a whole new era and a whole new type of practice.
It did, Michael. Until then, I'd had a probably the most prolific defamation practice any advocate has had in South Africa. I coincidentally did a defamation matter, not having done one before, and Jacques Lowe of the firm Lionel Murray Schwarmstedt and Lowe was my attorney, and he liked the way I handled it. And I then became, in the days when independent newspapers was a newspaper worth reading, I became the counsel of choice for all their defamation work. I also, in the days when he was a decent journalist, and he was a decent journalist for quite some time, I also acted for Martin Wiltz. I was sorry to see the journalist that he became, because he was a shadow of his former self. But I did the most incredible amount of defamation work, and it all came to an end with my silks taking silk status. And Jacques warned me that it would happen. He said that defamation is not a silks game. It's not a money-making thing in South Africa. It's the occasional point of principle. But there's one case in particular which was amazing. It was the case of an American man who professed to have invented the high-speed drill in dentistry, and he
Oh,
arrived
yes, I remember that case. Yes, okay. Tell us a bit about it. That's a
Dr.
bit of
Hall.
history.
He was a complete con man. He didn't invent the drill, and he was an international tax refugee running around the world with lots of money. And he came to South Africa because you could round trip money in those days. And Martin Wiltz wrote the most acutely accurate article on Dr. Hall, and the Cape Times published an article on what Martin had said about him. And in a very bad lapse of judgment, the legal team instituted action against both Wiltz and against the Cape Times, but they did it in one action. And Chris Whitfield, who was the editor of the Cape Times at the time, asked us where we stood with Martin. And we said, "Well, frankly, Martin needs us because the newspaper has the money and Martin has all the facts at his disposal." So it was a mistake.
Co-joined
It
twins,
was a mistake for them to join the two defendants to the same case. And Martin was having a very tough time and had got some costs orders against him. And they offered to withdraw against us and pay our costs at one stage. And Chris Whitfield, in a very brave moment, sat me down and said, "Where will Martin be if we settle?" And I said, "Quite frankly, he'll be up the creek without a paddle because he needs the legal team there, albeit not acting for him. We were on the same side as him. We were rowing in the same direction." The
Correct.
case ran in front of Judge Conradi. There was a great judge as well. Judge Conradie, who nobody liked except me, I don't think. I thought he was wonderful. We ran for 6 months, and his judgment reads that the institution of action by Dr. Hall must be considered a completely irrational moment. He ought never to even to have thought of litigating, knowing what he did about his own past. So
Ah,
that was
that.
a memorable case. The other one that really does stick in my memory is Independent versus Suleiman. Back in the days when the 7 o'clock news was still broadcast live on television and everyone watched it, the Cape Times had a habit of getting their front page ready and then watching the 7 o'clock news just in case something happened that would change what was going to be on the front page. And they had an article planned where they were going to not name someone who had been arrested by the police for being complicit in the Planet Hollywood bombing. And there on SABC News on Sunday night, no, it couldn't have been Sunday night, it was another night. There was the SABC naming Mr. Suleiman as being the Planet Hollywood bomber. And they were
They then
wrong.
printed it.
They were wrong.
Aye.
The police were wrong. He wasn't the Planet Hollywood bomber. And so but they decided based on the SABC's broadcast that they would look like yesterday's journalists if they came out attempting to conceal his name when it was already in the public domain. And so we were sued, and believe it or not, SABC was not.
Aye. Okay.
And Suleiman won in the Cape Provincial Division in front of Sylvain Selikowitz. And we went on appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeals. And they said that it was. They didn't decide it on the point that we wanted, that the prior publication had placed his name in the public domain. It was no longer newsworthy or defamatory to repeat it. But we effectively won the appeal. And Mr.
On what
Suleiman.
basis? How did you get that right?
It was basically a quantum basis, Michael, that they said that we had defamed him, but that the principal impugnment to his dignity had happened already. And
Ah,
the
okay.
quantum was very small, and so he lost the appeal because we'd made a payment into court.
Ah, okay. Wise, you took some insurance, as it were.
Yes, we did.
Which is quite clever. Just have a look at the case, Westbank versus the Minister of Customs and Excise.
Ah,
What actually
yes.
happened there? Because that's one of your more famous cases.
That was the case where Gauntlet and I had a fallout.
Yeah.
It was the first case, as far as I know, under the interim constitution. It concerned this ridiculous act under real apartheid stuff, but no, with no racial content, that the power of the Commissioner of Customs and Excise is that he could arrive at the premises of an excise debtor, such as someone running a factory. And I might be there at the factory with my camera, which was an imported good. And they could confiscate my camera because I happened to be on the premises of an excise debtor. And it was just so completely overbroad. It was a real sitter in the final analysis. And when Gauntlet and I had a fallout, Gauntlet was basically the only person who had any experience of and knowledge in constitutional law. But Andrew Breytenbach was fresh at the bar. And my source at Westbank said, just let's get Breytenbach and let's go ahead. We're not prepared to put up with this anymore. In fact, my Westbank contact phoned Gauntlet and said that he believes that there's a problem and he'd like to come down and fly down to Cape Town and discuss it with him. He said, no, I don't think we need to discuss it. We can just do it over the telephone. He said, no, if I'm going to replace you in the team, I'd like to know who takes over from you. So Gauntlet was fired from the matter and I was retained.
Well, that must have peeved him somewhat,
Yeah,
but
he wasn't a happy man.
just as we're coming slowly to the end of our interview, and I could carry on for hours, I'm enjoying this thoroughly. You once had a dispute. I think you were representing Wilbur Smith at the time. I don't know if you recall that, and I'm sure you do because. No more famous author coming out of Cape Town than he was, but tell us a bit
Yeah,
about it.
I will never forget that. He back in 1960 something, when the lion feeds was banned, He went to Oscar Rupp, a young attorney, who 30 years later was a not so young attorney. And Oscar came to me and said that he had a matter for Wilbur Smith, who had a spat with his stepson. What followed was far from a spat. It was, I think, seven or eight different pieces of litigation on three different continents. Kept me busy for 5 years. I got to know Wilbur very well. I landed up going to the Seychelles to look into the Seychelles leg of his litigation over there. I landed up giving evidence in a deposition for the American leg of the dispute, and I conducted the South African leg of the dispute, and it went on for 5 years. It was absolutely enormous. And I got
What
to the
transpired? I can't remember that. I just remember there was a real fight, and the stepson wasn't a pleasant sort of character. Was
No,
always reported in the Cape Times at the time.
that's correct. I was able to get some good coverage from the Cape Times by then. And his stepson asked him if he, it all started because his stepson asked him for the keys to the house in Bishop's Court because he wanted, quotes, to get his birth certificate. So Wilbur handed over the keys in all innocence, and his stepson went to his safe with some documents that would have been more comfortable for Wilbur not to ever to have seen the light of day. And he took them out in tranches, took them to a firm of attorneys, caused them to be photocopied, and caused them to be certified as copies of the originals, and put the originals back in his safe. And he bided his time until he got on the wrong side of Wilbur, because he must have known it was coming. And then he exposed all these documents in Wilbur's safe. And Wilbur only knew one thing, and that was attack, not defeat. And he relentlessly attacked his stepson over years until there was a kind of a wounded truce where things were
Both suitably unhappy.
both suitably unhappy by the end of 5 years of litigation.
And of course, it was good for you because you were able to become my neighbor and purchase a house up in Highlands Estate.
Indeed, and have five holidays, and have five holidays on Wilbur Seychelles Island.
I've still never been there, but I never met the man, never ever got to meet the man. And you were lucky enough to rub shoulders with the rich and famous. So interesting. Well, it's for me to now thank you, and I really do. I'm very much indebted to you to allowing me to have this 45 minutes with you. I appreciate some the stories that you've shared with us. I appreciate giving us a glimpse into the man, Steve Kirk Cohen, not just Steve Kirk Cohen SC, but Steve Kirk Cohen the man. And thank you very much for that. I value our friendship, and I salute you. And thank you very much for being on air with me tonight.
Thank you, Michael. Peace and shalom.
Thank you. Thanks very much.